This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have tried to work with the dogs to search for living persons, and so far we haven't found anyone.
That was Swedish firefighter Klaes-Ola Kolberg on why some international rescue workers are already leaving the scene of Morocco's earthquake. Details coming up. Also, the death toll from Libya's flooding has hit an estimated 11,000. And today's International Day of Democracy with the theme, Empowering the Next Generation. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Libyan authorities limited access to the city of Derna today to allow searches to dig for 10,000 people missing and fear dead from Sunday's flood. The Libyan Red Crescent estimates the current death toll at more than 11,000. Libya's two opposing governments, long divided by civil strife and war, have struggled to respond to a disaster of such great proportions. The United Nations aid chief said today Libya needs equipment to find people trapped, as well as primary health care to prevent disease outbreaks. Martin Griffiths said in Geneva, the UN Humanitarian Office has sent a disaster coordination team of 15 people to Libya, and he said it could be a viable option to bring aid to Derna, a Mediterranean port by sea. The collapse of two dams in Libya's Derna Valley led to massive floods that swept away neighborhoods and left thousands stranded. Libya's two rival governments are working to help survivors. For VOA, journalist Noura Hafaidi has more.
The devastated city of Derna in eastern Libya continues to count its dead from the floods caused by Storm Daniel. The dams upstream from the coastal city burst Sunday after the storm hit, sending water pouring into the city, sweeping away buildings and any people inside. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies have warned that 10,000 people are missing. Abu Bakr Amdad Azawi is Under Secretary General of the Ministry of Local Government and the government that controls eastern Libya.
The general command of the Libyan army intervened to manage an operation room in the city of Derna. The matter is going well and the rescue effort is continuing. The death toll is around 4,000 dead and there are 10,000 missing people. The disaster is great and we hope for the best in the Derna region and the surrounding areas.
Oil-rich Libya is divided between two rival governments. The United Nations brokered internationally recognized administration in Tripoli and the separate administration in the east. In a rare occurrence, the two rivals are cooperating in providing aid to the victims of the storm. The Tripoli government has sent a plane carrying aid to towns in the east hit by the storm and by floods, as well as financial aid and rescue operations by the eastern-based government of national stability. Aid has been sent or promised by numerous regions, including Algeria, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Qatar, Tunisia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as the Palestinians. Among the first aircraft to arrive in Benghazi, a 180-mile drive from Derna, were 8 Emirati planes carrying rescue teams, hundreds of tons of relief goods and medical aid. The United States has also pledged to help, and Europe, the aid efforts has been joined by Britain, Finland, France, Germany, Italy, and Romania. The United Nations, United States, European Union, and multimodal Eastern and North African nations have pledged to send rescue teams and aid, including food, water tanks, emergency shelters, medical supplies, and more body bags. Suzanne Hammi is the spokeswoman for the Libyan Assets Recovery Office for the Tripoli government and a member of the Libyan Parliament. She notes the rapid support for regional countries.
Algeria sent rescue teams, diving teams, and drilling tools. Egypt also sent lifting and drilling tools and trucks. I also know that Turkey sent a relief team to Derna. So far, the help is coming from Turkey, Egypt, and Algeria.
The International Organization for Migration in Libya said last Wednesday on the X platform that the last 30,000 have been displaced in Derna. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Noura Hfaid in Tunis, Tunisia.
Families in Morocco's High Atlas Mountains are still burying their dead a week after a 6.8 magnitude earthquake killed at least 2,900 people and injured more than 5,500. Hopes of finding survivors under the rubble are fading. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from the Atlas Mountains.
If there's a bright spot after this earthquake, it's the kindness of strangers. Moroccans donating truckloads of clothes and other basics to survivors. Fatma El Makra and her family are among those survivors. Like many others, they lost everything. She says about 20 people died in her village, including a neighbor hit by a rock as he tried to save his wife. She says when the disaster happened, they left everything behind and ran for their lives. Driving here is frightening. Steep cliffs, rock slides potentially triggered by aftershocks. One reason why aid was slow to get here. Now some international rescue workers are leaving, like Swedish firefighter Klas-Ola Kolberg.
We have tried to work with the dogs to search for living parcels. And so far, we haven't found anyone.
Many still alive are now homeless, like the family of Naima Azmil, who are having tea this morning. She says right now they have food, clothes, and shelter, but they're living day by day. They don't know about the future. That's a feeling here shared by many. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Emin Sili, Morocco.
Cameroon's National Communication Council has suspended one of the country's leading English-language newspapers, The Post, and its publisher for a month for reporting that most people in the Central African state are in favor of a military coup to oust long-serving leader Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The National Communication Council, or NCC, says it suspended the bi-weekly paper The Post and its publisher, Swam Silvanus Kini, for 1 month. Joseph Chebonken Kalabupse is NCC president. He says the journalists and newspaper are being punished for publishing information that is likely to disrupt national cohesion and social peace.
What I would urge our friends in private press to do is to remain as professional as possible. Let them not be at the beck and call of what I would qualify as powerful people.
Chebonken said the NCC could not be indifferent when information that could incite violence and jeopardize social peace is published. Chebonken was referring to this week's online version of The Post, which reported that 66% of Cameroonians are in favor of a military coup in the Central African state. NCC said The Post had no evidence that a majority of people want the military to take over from President Paul Biya. 90-year-old Biya has been Cameroon's president since 1982. Shortly after the report appeared, state broadcaster CRTV and the NCC said such a report was uncalled for when the military had just seized power in neighboring Gabon. The NCC sanction comes after government officials in Boya, where The Post is based, suspended the publication and distribution of the newspaper for an undetermined period. Paul Atanganji is Cameroon's territorial administration minister.
On purpose, it is act par ignorance.
Ngi says by sanctioning journalists who publish information that is misleading, Cameroonian authorities are simply doing their job as the law states. He says there should be no distraction because democratic institutions are functioning normally in Cameroon and constitutional order is in place. Ngi spoke on CRTV. Post executives say a staff member shared the edition carrying the report about pro-coup sentiment while it was still being prepared. The Post said it had punished the worker but gave no details. The NCC also suspended four other journalists with Galaxy FM Radio, Le Zenith newspaper, Flèche d'Afrique and Climat Social New Look for 1 to 2 months for what the council called professional misconduct. In its 2023 World Press Freedom Index, press freedom group Reporters Without Borders said Cameroon is one of Africa's most dangerous countries for journalists because of challenges to producing independent and critical journalism there. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wahib in Washington. Sudan is mired in a brutal conflict that has raged in for 5 months, claiming thousands of lives and uprooting millions from their homes. To gain more insight into the origins of this crisis and potential solutions, we are joined today in studio by Sudan expert Holid Hare, the founding director of the Khartoum-based think tank, Confluence Advisory. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you.
So what is this Confluence Advisory, the think tank you founded?
It was intended to work on policy-based or evidence-based policymaking during the transitional period, working on governance, peace and security, and the economy. We have since had to sort of reshape how we work after we were evacuated from Khartoum and therefore looking to.
Okay, so we have fighting between two generals, or you can say two warring factions, who have plunged Sudan into a dark hole where there is no end in sight. Talk to us a little about, as a Sudanese, it must be devastating. How do you feel?
I think this conflict, unlike or more than any other conflict that we've had, bearing in mind Sudan has had a very long history of conflict, but this conflict is going to indelibly change the political and social landscape of Sudan. The social fabric within the country has been torn apart in a way that I don't think we've seen in any other context to the same extent. Sudan has had two civil wars. Both have lasted on average around 20 years. We've had, of course, the Darfur conflict that started in 2003 and is still ongoing. And this war seems like it potentially follow the same historical trajectory. And that's because at its heart, this war is about a power struggle between two factions of the same military project in Sudan. And this is the military project of ousted President Omar al-Bashir. And this project is now, this military is now effectively at war with itself. But neither side has the full gamut of military options available to it because they're effectively the two, you know, two separate parts. So it's difficult to see how either one of them can gain enough of a military advantage to pursue a full victory. What this means is that we're likely to be in some kind of stalemate that is very hurting, not for the two sides, but for the civilians that are being caught in this for quite some time.
So what do we do moving forward? I mean, this is a stalemate, the way you're talking about.
I think the key needs to be to focus on the protection of civilians. The UNITAMS, the United Nations Integrated Mission in Sudan, was founded during the transitional period, but it does have some aspects of the mandate which are useful now, specifically looking at the protection of civilians element. And that means that the United Nations can put together protocols or practices that would ensure that there are safe zones for civilians and that they are not targeted as much by the two warring sides. And that's because there are two if you can, it's helpful to think about it as two simultaneous wars that are going on. There's one that we see very clearly between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces. And then there's the war against civilians. And that war is being waged by both the Sudan Armed Forces and the rapid support forces on civilians. And the idea there is that whomever comes on top militarily and politically will therefore then face less pressure from a sort of demoralized and trodden upon public.
This war you're talking about, war against civilians, let's talk about maybe the gender-based violence that's happening over there, a spike in sexual violence.
Absolutely. And this is not, again, looking at Sudan's previous conflicts, of which there have been many, this is absolutely part and parcel of the playbook of the Sudanese military and the factions that it has spawned. We have seen gender-based violence used, and specifically rape, used as a weapon of war. Just recently, human rights monitors have been documenting about 28 or so teenagers who crossed from Darfur, the rest of western region of Sudan, into neighboring Chad. And those 28 teenagers were all pregnant as a result of the rapes that they had endured in Darfur because of this conflict. Now, obviously, they are not able right now to get the level of support that they need in terms of rape kits, in terms of psychosocial support, and they will have to live with the results of this harrowing abuses that they face for a long time, almost without help. That is a very, very desperate situation. And the international community should now be looking not just at documenting these crimes, but helping to prevent them too.
Holud Heer, the founding director of the Khartoum-based think tank, Confluence Advisory, thank you for your input.
Thank you.
As the world commemorates the International Day of Democracy, September 15th, some young people are calling on African leaders to include them in decision-making positions. This year's theme, Empowering the Next Generation, focuses on the role of children and young people in safeguarding democracy. Kathy Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
Young people make up half of the population of Africa, but they are marginalized in many countries, including in Zambia. According to the United Nations, democracies in which the people hold power provide an environment that respects fundamental rights and freedoms, allowing for the free expression of different views. Yet, the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, IDEA, an intergovernmental organization, recently reported that more countries are moving toward authoritarianism as democracy shrinks worldwide. The Stockholm-based watchdog says half of the world's democracies are in a state of decline amid worsening civil liberties and rule of law, while already authoritarian governments are becoming more oppressive. Tinashe Mazala is a young leader and co-founder of the Center for Young Leaders in Africa, a group that champions the inclusion and representation of young people in Zambia and Malawi. She says more needs to be done to ensure the equal participation of young people in African democracies.
There are many moments of triumph that we can look back on and be proud of, and we can see how the youth greatly participated in achieving or making these things possible. But on the other hand, the reality is when it comes to inclusion, particularly in the decision-making spheres that matter the most, the youth is still very underrepresented.
Kellys Mushota is a young trade union leader with the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. He underscores the significance of this year's theme.
It is important and cardinal to empower young people like myself with knowledge and skills in order for us to foster, participate currently and futuristically in safeguarding and sustaining democratic processes. This sits well with the theme of empowering the next generation for the purpose of safeguarding democracy.
For Mazala, the colonial era laws that restrict the freedom of assembly and the lack of affirmative action for marginalized groups like youths and women need to be improved in many African countries. She gives an example of at least one of many old laws that needs to be changed.
The tenets of democracy, like our institutions and our laws, which are in many ways not evolving or not being amended to support a healthy democracy. An example that I will give is the Public Order Act, which many governments speak against when they're in opposition, but do nothing to alter and change when they take up power.
In a message to commemorate this year's International Day of Democracy, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres notes that democracy, the rule of law, and respect for human rights are bedrocks of resilient, inclusive, and peaceful societies. For VOA News, I'm Kathy Short in Lusaka, Zambia.
South Africa's Competition Commission is investigating U.S. drug maker Johnson & Johnson for the high price it charges the country for the tuberculosis medicine Bedaquiline. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa has one of the highest tuberculosis rates in the world. Even though it's curable, TB kills more people in the country than any other disease. Bedaquiline treats multi-drug-resistant TB, which doesn't respond to standard treatment. Using it for 6 months means patients don't have to suffer 2 years of injections that can have serious side effects. South Africa's Competition Commission, however, is investigating J&J because of its new contract with the health department. Under the contract, which begins in October, South Africa pays more than double for the drug than many other countries. J&J will charge South Africa 5,500 rands, or $290, per course of Bedaquiline. Other developing countries with high TB rates pay $130 when they buy the drug through the Stop TB Partnerships Global Drug Facility, which is linked to the United Nations. South Africa is not part of the Global Drug Facility. Candace Sehoma is the campaign officer for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF.
Another critical issue which enables this price gouging by Johnson & Johnson is their patent monopoly. Johnson & Johnson holds a patent monopoly in South Africa until 2027, which means that despite the availability of generics, this patent monopoly blocks other cheaper generics from supplying South Africa.
She explains that through a process known as evergreening, pharmaceutical manufacturers make small changes to medicines to keep their market monopoly. This, says Sehoma, allows drug makers to keep patents beyond the standard 20 years, blocking competitors who make the same products at cheaper prices from the market. Fatima Hassan, director of the Health Justice Initiative nonprofit, says the South African investigation into J&J is historic.
This, we believe, is unprecedented. We do not know of any other investigation into a pharmaceutical company by the Competition Commission of South Africa for the evergreening practices, which are regarded as exclusionary conduct. We believe that Johnson & Johnson has been informed overnight that they are now under investigation. And obviously with MSF and many other TB activists and campaigners around the world, we will now make sure that we provide all the information to the competition authorities in South Africa so that this investigation can be thorough and can be completed expeditiously so that patients and people in South Africa are no longer prejudiced by both the pricing, exploitative pricing, I might add, conduct of Johnson & Johnson, as well as its evergreening practices and consequences. And this comes...
In a media statement, J&J described itself as a long-standing and committed partner in South Africa's fight against multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. The company said all patients in the country who require Bedaquiline have access to it, thanks to J&J's collaboration with the government. The company said that had contributed to a steady decline in TB cases in South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Kayla Williams, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.